Welcome to Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. On today's episode, we are joined by Paul Gilmore, who is a history professor at Fresno City College, and we're so excited to have Paul with us today. So welcome.
Thank you.
So we're going to dive right into today's topic, which is about the Fresno's free speech fight. And for our listeners, this is a topic in local history that I think a lot of people haven't necessarily heard about. And Paul recently gave a talk at Tioga Sequoia about this event. And so that's part of the reason why we wanted to have him join us. But there's actually, the way I learned about this was the city is in the process of updating Mariposa Plaza, a plaza in the middle of downtown Fresno on the corner of Fulton and Mariposa. And there's a little plaque at Mariposa Plaza that talks about Fresno's free speech fight, and it's considered the home of free speech in Fresno. And you don't always hear about moments like this. So I would love, Paul, if you could just give us the whole story. What is Fresno's free speech fight?
It was way back in 1910, long before the Berkeley free speech fight, long before the classic period of the civil rights movement where you had lots of civil disobedience. 1910, the industrial workers of the world, a very radical union, came to town, was organizing workers here on the corner, right where you were mentioning, right where that historical marker is. And because they were organizing workers, especially really the lowest of the low as far as the hierarchy of workers, people who are just spit on, they were organizing them, and the powers that be in town didn't like it and started arresting folks for speaking on the street corner. It was a thing that the IWW did.
What industries are we talking about that these people would have been part of?
A lot of the IWW itself came out of the Western Federation of Miners. Maybe we could talk about that in a little bit. But here in the Valley, they were organizing migrant farm workers. And actually, the newspapers would talk about they had to shut down a meeting the other night because the IWW had sponsored a Mexican socialist to come and talk to the peons. And this is in the San Francisco Call newspaper. They're riling up the peons against the Fresno police.
And what a title for a newspaper article.
Wow. Yeah.
But that was they had some success in stopping the building of a small dam outside of town. And so the powers that be basically, one newspaper says it's the Santa Fe Railroad was really pushing this to crack down on them and arrest them. So that's what they started to do, arrest these guys for speaking on the street. And then they called on people from all over the country, really, to ride the rails to Fresno, to come to Mariposa and stand on a soapbox and say a few words. It would only be a few words, you'd get arrested, and then get thrown in jail. And the idea was to fill the jails to secure the right to freedom of speech in Fresno. So at its peak, things started kicking off in April of 1910, but really started going in October 1910. And by February 1911, they had 175 people in the Fresno jail. They had just filled it. That was beyond capacity. Yeah. And they just kept on coming and getting arrested till finally the city gave in and said, okay, you have a right to talk in this town. There's a hell of a lot more detail to it, but that's the basic story right there.
How was the fight portrayed in local newspapers at the time?
The Fresno Morning Republican is actually pretty good at just giving you the facts, right? But it's clear that most people viewed the IWW as a real nuisance, a bunch of bums and hobos. But the nickname of the IWW was the I Won't Work. These bindle stiffs, these guys who carry everything on a stick, right? You've seen the cartoon pictures, everything wrapped up in a handkerchief. But people moving from worksite to worksite, farm to farm, following the crops. So that was a huge number. But the IWW also organized miners and lumber workers. And out east, their probably most famous strike was the Bread and Roses strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts. 20,000 mainly immigrant women rising up against the textile mill owners. But back here, the job was ag mainly. That was the main job that they were organizing. And the supposed mainstream unions wouldn't touch ag workers with a 10-foot pole.
Why not?
They were Mexican, Japanese, Chinese. And when it came to the Chinese workers, there was just virulent incredible amounts of racism. In 1892, this town got together and drove the Chinese community out of town. So all up and down the valley, the Chinatowns were burned to the ground. In L.A., there was a pogrom against Chinese folks. And so this is just a couple decades later, the mainstream labor movement saw Chinese workers as racially incapable of bargaining for higher wages. It's a real vicious kind of racism. And that's what kind of makes the IWW unique, because here this is the most radical union in the country, and they organized anybody. If you're a worker, you can be organized, which was unusual. And same with Mexican-American and Mexican immigrant workers. They were considered not worth the time of the aristocracy of labor, the highly skilled workers who were in unions.
How would they have understood free speech then? How did they understand what they were doing by speaking out?
I think in the case of the IWW, they were anarchists, but they were appealing to the Constitution of the United States, the First Amendment, which is pretty clear. Yeah. Congress shall make no law. And there it is. Here we are gathering, assembling for a redress of our grievances, and this is what's happening to us. And so I think they saw it as a constitutional right. That's the way they played it to the rest of the country. This community, a lot of people in this community, the better sort, supposedly, saw them as a threat. Of course, you can say what you want, but you, within limits. You can't disparage the police. You can't disparage the mayor, the city fathers. These things you're not allowed to do. They get arrested for it. The notion was incitement, I think. This idea that if you say the wrong words, you're going to incite people to commit actually illegal acts. And they took that little tiny door and just blasted a hole in it to say, all right, anything you say are things that are going to incite people to lawlessness, and so therefore you yourself are lawless. And the main organizer, he was a veteran of these things, of organizing among miners, but also of other free speech fights in the country, and Frank Little was his name. And he spent half his life in jail, and the other half getting the crap kicked out of him by... That's okay to say.
Yeah, we're good.
He was, by the time he got to Fresno, he was almost dead already. I mean,
Why did the IWW choose Fresno to organize?
I think it was just the next site.
Sure.
Frank Little had just come off the Spokane, Washington free speech fight, and he had relatives down here, Emma and Fred Little. They lived on Belmont, and he was staying there and recovering, and they had a little local here, local 66 of the IWW, and it was a family affair, I guess. And so it was just coincidental that it was Fresno. I'm sure if it had been Madera, they would have had the fight there. But Fresno also was the capital city of the Central Valley, the big raisin hub here. So only 25,000 people, but still the capital city of the valley. And so it would be the natural place to choose if you're going to do a fight among agricultural workers. And Frank Little, even though he came out of mining, out of the world of mining, and organizing among the Western Federation of Miners, he was very much into organizing agricultural workers. It's weird because if you look back in the Midwest, the story of agriculture is farm families. And the IWW looked at farmers and said, you're not really workers, you're business owners. And you come out here to the West, and if you have that same mentality, like a lot of the organizers did, they didn't even look at farming as a place to organize. But these are farm workers. There's a book, Factories in the Field, talking about California agriculture. You've got an army of thousands and thousands of wage workers working in the fields. It certainly wasn't the case where I grew up in Wisconsin. You just never saw that. But out here, we've got it all the way down to today.
So how should we look at this in the history of Fresno labor? Is this a major pivot point? Is this kind of a blip in terms of a spike of acute violence followed by a return to stasis?
Return to stasis, probably. It's one of these kind of stories of history that's been vetoed. All right, we don't talk about it. There was no lasting organization that was ever created here. But I think when I say we don't talk about it, it's not something that makes the history books. It's not something that you get taught in high school or whatever. But it would be nice to know the sort of underground the way the underground delivers stories to each other. There's certainly there is a direct connection between the free speech fight here and the attempt to organize agricultural workers here in 1910, 1911, and so on, and the big cotton strike of 1933, the biggest agricultural strike in all of American history, the 1933 cotton strike. I'm sure there are IWW veterans in that strike in 33, some tens of thousands of people out on strike. And that, too, has been vetoed from our history. Almost nobody knows about that. Four people were killed. It was just an awful situation. And then 30 years later, the next generation rise up again. But we know that one, Cesar Chavez and the UFW, and everybody's heard that story. But my guess is you've got the grandparents right there. I shouldn't say my guess. In the case of the 33 cotton strike, there's a lot of these IWW veterans that are involved, and Mexican Revolution veterans involved in that strike. It's really quite something.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
So is it safe to say that this free speech fight that happened in 1910, 1911, did it change city politics at the time or the way that the powerful sort of interacted with workers?
I think what it did is it revealed that Fresno, believe it or not, was the center of the progressive movement in California. It was a hinge between Northern and Southern California. It was the place where the Northern California progressives in San Francisco, trying to clean up that city, met with the Southern California progressives. And Chester Roll, the editor of the Fresno Morning Republican, and his uncle, Chester Roll, the mayor of the city, they were progressives. Chester, the editor, Chester, was the founder, one of the founders of the Lincoln Roosevelt League, the great progressive organization to take over the Republican Party, to put Hiram Johnson in charge as governor of California.
Elected that same year when this was going on.
Exactly. Yeah. And this was women's right to vote, basic, a lot of labor law, right? Workers' compensation, free textbooks in the schools, initiative referendum and recall to try to do an end run around the big political machines. So very activist reform government. But this did not include the IWW. It didn't really include organized labor at all. This was what they thought of themselves doing, I think, is rationalizing the political order. The IWW was there to be crushed, to be controlled. It was a different kind of vision. In a way, it's the losers of history teaching us a lesson about the limits of reform politics, maybe you could say. I don't know if that answered your question.
No, it definitely does. I think it's interesting, and I would just love to hear more about sort of Fresno's connection to progressive movements, because there's this common trope that Fresno has always been a deeply conservative place, and yet you hear about these little blips on the radar and you know that there is another narrative to tell.
Yeah, we do this as historians. We take a decade and we say this was the 20s, so therefore it's the roaring 20s, the jazz age, and so we're going to talk about speakeasies and flappers, and we're going to talk about it in one sort of way, just partying and having fun and that kind of stuff. And then in the 30s, well, everybody was depressed. It was the Great Depression. And then in the 40s, we've got war. And then in the 50s, we've got suburbs and consumer society. And the 60s was revolt. 70s was meat. But this is not the way it works. There's always the thread of the other thing. California was supposedly the great liberal radical place in the 1960s, but we elected Ronald Reagan, governor of California, in the same decade. In the same way, the story stamping a city with a kind of political identity does harm to that. You want to make some kind of general statement.
Yeah.
Fresno is a fairly conservative city. Okay, yes. But there's always counter trends. There's always some kind of thread underneath. And a lot of times that underground history is a lot more significant than we think, and that's why it has been buried. Look, 1910 to 1920 in California was a time of almost full-scale engagement. Class war was going on.
And it culminates at the end of this period with that serious repression, the invention of the FBI.
Yep.
There's a great book that just came out called American Midnight, and it's about that violent peace that followed World War I, and we don't really cover that.
Adam Hochschild.
Yeah.
And in that book, he mentions how the nascent FBI, J. Edgar Hoover and his Justice Department folks, and then the post office inspectors, stopped a shipment of several hundred copies of The Masses, which was the Communist Party magazine, to Emma Little's home in Fresno. It's mentioned in that yeah. book. And Emma Little was the wife of Fred Little, but very much an activist in her own right. As a matter of fact, the activist in the family. By this time, Fred Little was, her husband was dropping, well, that's a whole other story. And Frank Little had gone on to other things. Actually, by this time, Frank Little had been assassinated in Butte, Montana, by a vigilante mob for organizing a strike during World War I. He was dragged out of his bed at 3 a.m. and tied to the back of a car and dragged out to the outskirts of town and hanged from a bridge. And that's how Frank Little, the guy who ran our free speech fight, that's how he ended up, just murdered by the copper bosses. There's a little neat little story there too, because Dashiell Hammett, whose first novel is Red Harvest, yeah. it's supposedly based in Butte, Montana. It's a town called Personville, but pronounced Poisonville. It's
Poisonville. I think they made a good movie of that. Yeah.
And the Hammett himself, later on in life, told his wife Lillian Hellman that he was actually hired. They tried to hire him to kill Frank Little. Yeah. They offered him $5,000 to kill Frank Little. So they got somebody else to do it. But
yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Can I drill back? I want to drill back into Donnie's question for a second.
Okay.
Are we missing? No. I just want to. I want to hit on this. Are we misunderstanding? Are people misunderstanding Fresno to say it's always been a deeply conservative place? Is that? Would you say that's a misunderstanding?
I think no, not terribly. There's. I think sometimes progressivism, as we understand it, has a kind of tinge of conservatism to it, even though we see them as total opposite poles.
Yeah, it means a different, that word means different things in different times.
Yeah, yeah. You want to rationalize a vast network of irrigation, you're going to engage in some new reform of the water law, which we had zero before 1913. That very conservative farmers are going to embrace that, even though that's massive government massive expansion of the state and state power over water. That's a progressive reform by very conservative folks. You take the most reactionary figures in all of California, the owner of the LA Times. The LA Times supported at a certain point public power, because they didn't want private utilities to basically lord it over other business people.
And that's when they got bombed in the 1910s.
Yeah.
The 1910s are a lot of fun, fun in quotation marks, if you're looking for interesting history.
Yeah. At the time of the free speech fight here in Fresno, the LA Times was bombed, and there was a tight mayoral race going on between Job Harriman, the socialist, and just a regular George Alexander, I think, was the name of the guy. But the socialists looked like they were going to win, and then the LA Times building was bombed, and Job Harriman was, well, tarred with that. Anyway, that's a whole other story. You have to remember, though, that Fresno was one node in this sort of larger story of the IWW and this big fight happening in the 1910s, and really, World War I really is quite the moment there. You want to talk about a crackdown on civil liberties. We haven't seen anything like it since. And we've had some pretty bad moments with COINTELPRO and all of that.
I was going to ask, we're in yet another moment where it feels like there are a lot of threats to free speech, to First Amendment rights, to both just everyday people, protesters, activists. How should we think about how today's moment in time compares with that period of time?
There are important lessons to learn. One is use it or lose it. If you don't use your free speech rights, you don't really have them. So if you shut up preemptively, then they've already won. But it is important to remember that when you use those basic rights to really challenge power, that power will crack down on you. And no matter what sort of protections you might have. And so I think a lesson here is that there's power in numbers. Having one person get arrested and thrown in jail is not going to do much of anything in the case of the free speech fight. But filling the jails, paying for three hots and a cot for 174 of these bums who are constantly screaming and yelling and singing in the jail. They brought out the fire department and filled the jail half full of freezing cold water in the middle of winter to try to get these guys to shut up. A vigilante mob went out to their encampment on the outskirts of town and burned it down. A big, huge tent at Belmont and Palm, that was the outskirts of town at the time.
Wow.
They burned down the camp. So it wasn't just the authorities. Now you've got almost semi-deputized vigilantes doing the same thing. I guess the lesson for us today is to expect that things might escalate into that. We're not that much different than people 110 years ago. The KKK in Fresno in the late teens and early 20s became a power of its own throughout the nation, but they were the vigilante mob taking on the IWW. There was a big moment there in San Pedro down in Southern California where the KKK attacked and burned down the IWW building.
Really?
Yeah.
How active was the KKK in Fresno?
By the 1920s, very active, but that might be another story that you could talk to a next student of mine about someday. Yeah, very active. The Fresno City College baseball field was actually for a long time named after in the defense of Fresno City College, they didn't quite understand that Euless was the head of the KKK in Fresno in the 1920s, but it didn't stop them from naming the baseball field after him. Now it's just called the ballpark.
America's pastime.
The KKK, there was a big scandal because a lot of the cops were members of the Klan, and it's a secret organization, and so they were fired, and they wanted their jobs back. And there was a lot of corruption within the police here. It was a wide-open town, so you got bootlegging on one hand, the K on the other, so quite a story there. But a lot of the sort of mentality of the KKK, the embrace of the KKK, was this idea that somehow we're going to have 100% Americanism. America first was their slogan. What we need to do is make sure that we keep control of our community, keep it out of the hands of radicals like the IWW and the people that the radicals are organizing, especially this mobile population of migrant workers who are racially considered un-American by the KKK. And so I see the KKK of the 20s as a pretty easy kind of, there's a straight line between vigilante group in 1910, 11, 12, and the KKK of the 20s, the silver shirts of the 30s, John Birchers of the 50s, and draw your own conclusions.
So you teach students at Fresno City College. Yeah. When you talk about free speech with them, what are the things you hear about? What are the questions they ask you?
I think the assumption that most of my students have is that there are lots of limits that actually aren't there officially.
Okay.
And some of it is just hate speech, for instance. It's legal. You're a jerk,
yeah,
right? But
yeah,
you can do it. You can say whatever words you want. They're very narrow. The U.S. is pretty open about freedom of speech, and I think most of our students don't know that. They think that there's a lot more control over it than there officially is. But that's because we all police ourselves. That's the main way that we police speech, not through the state or some authority, but we police ourselves.
Interpersonal.
Yeah. In the case of Fresno City College, they have these little free speech areas. That's only now just ended. But for years and years, the idea was that you could do all your free speech in this little patch of ground over here, but not on the rest of the campus. You're going to get sued. They got sued. Now they had to change their rules. So
yeah.
Can I tell you a good little story about there's a guy, one of the first people I ever saw do a concert in Fresno was Utah Phillips. And Utah Phillips was an old folk singer. He was an old IWW guy. He was the voice of the hobos. That kind of guy. He was an old guy. He did his concert at the Underground Gardens, which is rare. They almost never have a concert there.
I was going to say, I didn't know you could do that.
Oh, it was like 22 years ago. I had just moved here. And it was one of the things that made me feel like, I can live in Fresno. But he sung all the old wobbly songs. You'll get pie in the sky when you die. You know, lots of great wobbly songs. He did this little talk about freedom of speech, though, or freedom in general. He said, freedom is something you assume, like your eyes, your ears, your nose. You're born with it. And then what you do is you act like you're free, and then wait till somebody tries to take it away from you, and the extent to which you resist is the extent to which you are free. And I like that notion. It's a very libertarian, very anarchist kind of notion of freedom of speech, but you do find out your limits once you begin to actually do it. I told this story one time. I was asked to tell this story right down at Mariposa and I for a little rally. And I was invited there to talk about the history of it. And when I got there, the organizer was hanging a sign on a tree, and a police officer walked over and said, "Hey, you can't hang that sign there." Right? And she says, "Oh, no, we're just here for an hour. I'll take it down after it's over." And the officer gets upset. He says, "Lady, you're going to have to take that sign down." And the organizer said, "Oh, I see where this is going. Arrest me." And the guy walked away, and we had our thing. But for me, at least, that was later on. That was at the time, I'm scared. I'm like, I don't know this person. It was for me that she was doing it. She's arrest me. She puts her wrists out. But that's the thing. You get an idea of what it is if you do it. You don't really get an idea of what it is until you do something. I think sometimes people forget the significance of freedom of speech. It's the base on which any movement, no matter right, left, center, or whatever, on which any movement. You can't have your movement if you're going to be shut up. Yeah. We used to have the criminal syndicalism law that came in, partly because of the IWW, basically making it illegal to be a member of any group that talks about the overthrow of the industrial order. And it was used to just crush people who today we would see as heroes, people demanding the 8-hour day, people the right to bargain, the right to a minimum wage, end of child labor. That's what was being crushed by these things. But anyway, I to circle back around to Utah Phillips, I just love that little piece there. And then he went on and sung a bunch more songs. Yeah, it was
nice.
Good. Yeah.
Maybe we'll resurrect concerts at the Underground Garden.
Yeah, yeah. Every time I talk to the folks out there, they say, yeah, we're thinking about it.
Okay.
So, well, that would be great. Yeah.
Excellent.
We close these podcasts every week with what we're loving this week. I'll go ahead and start. I am in the process of moving, and I've been buying a lot of things secondhand, online, offer up, Facebook Marketplace, those kinds of things. And I've been spiraling out on these YouTube accounts where people flip Goodwill items, and I am not handy whatsoever. I'm a cerebral person. I read a lot of books and live in my mind, and so I'm trying to do something a little bit more physical with
my time.
I have
a hand sander if you need one.
You have a hand sander. Okay, I might need to borrow that. Paul, what are you loving this week?
I just got back from Oakland, and I'm loving my backyard. I've got a nice little fountain and lots of mature trees, and I built a big garden wall, and I like staring at it. So
that sounds there lovely. We go.
And it's been nice. We've had some nice weather for a couple days.
Yeah.
Donnie?
Last night was beautiful.
Yes.
What about you?
I just got back from New Orleans. I had a work conference, which was excellent.
What did you eat?
I'm not a big seafood person.
Did you have beignets?
I had so many beignets.
Oh, good. Okay.
So many beignets.
Are they a little overrated at this point? Okay. Because I've heard there's like a range. I've never actually been to New Orleans. It's a city that I've always wanted to go to.
Yeah,
I haven't been.
You've got to go.
But I've heard there's a range. You have some really good ones
yes,
and some pedestrian
beignets.
This is true. Beignets.
But if your experience about beignets is Disneyland, then your mind will be blown even by the most mid beignets in New Orleans.
Because they're like cousins to funnel cakes, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Very much.
Okay, but these are thicker, denser, more like a donut looking.
Well, yes, but some of them are like, there were some that I had that were more donut bread. And then there was one place I went that it was like a croissant almost. And it was almost crispy on the outside and then had mini layers of thin dough on the inside. And it was like pillowy on the inside.
Oh, man.
It was so good.
I'm getting the bread sweats just listening to this.
So I had great beignets. I had great grits, fried chicken. I don't even remember. I had great brisket, a devil's egg, potato salad. But I'm not like a big crawfish person, so I felt very guilty for not indulging in that way. I was only there for 2 days.
Did you see any roaches?
I did not see any roaches.
Oh, good for you. Good.
There was one place I went that had alligator risotto balls, but I did not try them.
I'm enticed. Yes, I need to go just for that.
But the food was great, but I also went to an excellent jazz show on Friday night, so that was really fun. Highly recommend.
This has been Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. And this podcast was recorded at Sun Stereo Warehouse in downtown Fresno. Audio editing and mixing was done by Jordan Maddox. Our lead image comes from Vaughn Ballinan. And our song comes from Stateless Rat.